very little is coming.
Welcome to the March 16th meeting of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. We've got a number of bills up today, and we're going to start with Senate Bill 441. James.
Mr. Chair.
Representative, come on up.
Committee members, Senate Bill 441 permits the Trust for Cultural Development Board to solicit and accept gifts, bequests or devices of money, securities, other property, directs income from property to be credited to the Trust for Cultural Development account, creates a minimum of no less than 50% and a maximum of no more than 60% that must be dispersed from the Trust for Cultural Development account each fiscal year, changes maximum amount from 7.5% to $400,000 that arts program may use from amounts dispersed from the account for certain purposes, changes remaining amounts dispersed from account for Cultural Development grant program, community cultural participation grant program, and core partner agencies, declares emergency effective on passage. There is no revenue impact, and there is a fiscal light impact, and there's a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
With a fiscal light, there's a subsequent referral?
Fiscal light.
There is.
How about that? Welcome,
Thank
Representative.
You. Thank you.
Others?
For the record, I'm Representative Margaret Doherty, and I represent House District 35, which is Tigard in Southwest Portland. And I'm very delighted to be here today to talk about supporting Senate Bill 441, which is on your, in front of your committee. And actually, Senator Steiner here, we're sent to regret. She was going to come and also speak in favor of this bill, but had another obligation. So I'm just going to go through and kind of give an introduction and leave it over to the pros with this. But Senate Bill 441, we've been having a lot of discussion in the off session with the Oregon Cultural Trust and the Arts Committee with Arts. And I am the House representative to the Oregon Cultural Trust Board, as Senator Steiner Hayward is the Senate representative. And during this, in the couple of years that I've been here, I've always been very impressed with what your cultural trust has done, because they've been able to give money to over 1,400 a year, 1,400 cultural groups, all nonprofits in every county and many of the cities in the state of Oregon. This bill is very important, because when we go through and talk about the cultural trust and the mechanics of either distribution of money or bringing in of funds, it really hasn't been changed probably since the cultural trust was founded in whenever it was founded many years ago by Ben Weslin. But it's important because these updates, at least with part of it, allow us to expand our intake of the gifts that we have now. It's finance money, but it could also be things like property and other things to support the arts. I think one of the most important things is the distribution formula, because it's been set in statute for a long time as to how much money we will distribute of the funds that we've collected for the year before. And so that's going from a floor of from 42% up to 50% as a floor, and to be able to expend close to 60% of the monies raised in the previous year. Mm-hmm. And if I'm mistaken about this, these folks will give you the straight scuttle. But it just gives us more money to give to groups. And last year we gave over $1.8 million to these. And so the whole purpose of this is to kind of modernize and update what the Cultural Trust does financially and with their distribution and some other things. And so I strongly support House Bill 441. And I would like to turn it over to our director, Brian Rogers.
Great. Thank you. For the record, I'm Brian Rogers. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Arts Trust, the Cultural Trust, and the Oregon Arts Commission. Eileen?
My name is Eileen Schreiner. I am the manager of the Oregon Cultural Trust.
I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to provide some context on Senate Bill 441 and offer an update about the Oregon Cultural Trust. The Trust is a department in Business Oregon, and the Trust was established about 12 years ago. The Trust is governed by a board of 9 community members and 2 legislative advisors, and Representative Doherty is one of those advisors. The Trust plays a vital role in building Oregon communities through sustaining, developing, and increasing opportunities for Oregonians to participate in our diverse arts, heritage, history, and humanities. Our mission is to lead in building an environment in which cultural organizations are sustained and valued as a core part of vibrant Oregon communities. We act on that mission by raising and distributing funding and grants and services to every county of the state each and every year. In fiscal year 2014, it was another record year for the trust, raising over $4.3 million, which is a 4% increase over last year. And last year, we distributed $1.8 million in grants, and $2.7 million of the $4.3 was placed into our permanent fund, which is now at over $25 million. This ensures that future generations of Oregonians may participate in culture as we have in the past and as we do now. Individual participation in the Trust Donation Tax Credit Program encourages over 8,800 individuals and couples to participate, thereby leveraging local philanthropy. The average donation to the Trust is $490, which means individuals are also donating at least that amount to one or more of the 1,400 participating cultural organizations in the state. In a recent national study called Building Public Will for the Arts and Culture, which is managed by the Metropolitan Group based here in Oregon, findings included data that Oregonians value experiencing culture at a much higher rate than the national average. We correlate this to the work of the Cultural Trust. The Cultural Trust not only makes direct grants, but also works with county cultural partners and 45 county and tribal coalitions. Our dedication to reaching every region and county of the state provides extensive regional support in rural areas and hard-to-reach places. We do this with over 400 cultural coalition volunteers. And one quick example, in the city of Bandon and on the southern coast, artist and teacher Angela Posey created a now internationally renowned environmental art and education project titled Washed Ashore. This project was funded by a $500 seed grant from the Coos County Cultural Coalition. Posey works with coastal communities to collect debris from Oregon's public beaches to create sculptures that illustrate the scope and scale of trash in our oceans. Posey's Artula Institute for Arts and Environmental Education is now a nonprofit community-based organization whose mission is to provide opportunities to express and teach environmental issues through the arts and culture. The trust is an investment in Ms. Posey's and all Oregonians' vision for a brighter future. Since 2001, when the trust was founded by the legislature, a lot of developments and changes have occurred. This bill would enable the trust to respond to and continue to grow and provide the level of service that Oregonians have come to expect. Given that the trust growth rate in donations has been averaging between 4 and 5% each year, we have found ourselves at full capacity in accepting donations, providing support to our county coalitions, and developing strong, lasting programs in coordination with our cultural partners. Modernizing the trust will enable the board to review and implement policies and practices that respond to the changing environment in which we operate, helping the trust to better serve Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian, and welcome to Oregon. I haven't had a chance to say that before.
Thank you very much.
It's great. I did have one question. It has nothing to do with this, but you might know. I think it was two sessions ago we were talking about changing the investment criteria to allow a better return. The criteria that we had with this did not allow for as good a return as we had on some other state funds. Did we ever do that?
We worked very closely with the treasurer's office. Actually, this all occurred right before I started the position, but we are in a better investing portfolio vis-a-vis the treasurer's office. But thank you for that suggestion. It was very helpful.
This is a great thing. This is this one's close to my heart. This is a thing that Ben Westland and I worked on in '99, and along with a number of other Oregonians, that was a great idea.
Yes.
I would say the tax credit was my idea. His was the state buildings we were going to sell, which we never have gotten around to. The questions on this? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Campbell.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell, and I'm here on behalf of the Cultural Advocacy Coalition. I'll keep my comments very brief. We fully support the bill that's in front of you and wanted to take a moment to emphasize our thanks for the work that has been done by Representative Doherty, Senator Steiner Hayward, Mr. Rogers, Kendall Clausen, and the other partners that we have that were around the table that generated the work that's in front of you. And we fully support it because we know that this will allow for greater investment in the work of cultural nonprofits while protecting our current statewide partners, tribes, and our county cultural coalitions. And so we urge your support of the bill.
You said that all without taking a breath.
I've been in training.
I was impressed.
Questions? Seamus, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That's all I had signed up on Senate Bill 441. Is there anybody else who wishes to speak on this bill? Let me see here. Maybe we have them. Yep. So we will close public hearing. We'll open the work session on Senate Bill 4441. There's no amendments, correct?
Correct.
So the chair would move Senate Bill 4441 to the floor with the due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Is it Ways and Means or Revenue?
Did I say it wrong? I thought you said Ways and Means.
It's Ways and Means.
Ways and Means. I don't know why it has very minimal fiscal impact, but the co-chair's greedy hands wanted to get a hold of it.
Fund sweeping?
Fund sweeping, yeah. They tried that once before.
They did that once before.
Yes. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, Senate Bill 4441. That's hard to say all in one breath. I have to get Campbell's help. It's moved to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. We'll close on 441, and we will, let's see, where do we want to go now?
117.
We want to go to 117?
Mm-hmm.
We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 117. James.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 117 creates task force on jurisdictional transfers, sunsets task force on December 31st, 2016, declares emergency effective upon passage. There is no revenue impact and there is a fiscal impact.
Okay. Who did I have on 7?
I texted him. He's on his way.
I was waiting for Senator Dembro, but he's not coming through the door, so we'll just go ahead and start on the list. Andy? Oops. You'll excuse us just a minute. Senator Dembro, we're on 117.
Thank you.
What busy lives we lead.
Welcome.
Thank you. Senator Beyer, members of the committee, I'm Michael Dembro, and I am the state senator for District 23. That's Northeast Portland and Southeast Portland. And the Northeast Portland includes the city within a city of Maywood Park. So I'm here to present Senate Bill 117 to you. Senate Bill 117 is the idea of creating a task force to work on the issue of jurisdictional transfers. That is, taking what are known as orphan highways, state roads that enter into cities, and transferring them, when appropriate, to city control. Or in some cases, the opposite. Sometimes we have city or county roads that really should be state roads. This is an issue that I became familiar with because my district includes 82nd Avenue in Portland. When I was the House representative for District 45, I had the northern part of 82nd. And now that I'm a senator and representing District 23, I have all of 82nd Avenue going down to Clackamas County. And 82nd Avenue is, as many of you know, it's a very important thoroughfare, but it's one where local residents really see it as a barrier that separates their district. Where 82nd Avenue should be a thoroughfare that joins together the west side of Portland and the east side of the county. And so a lot of people have been talking to me about what can we do about creating you know, making 82nd Avenue no longer an ODOT road, but a PBOT road. And I've been working with ODOT on this issue. ODOT has been very supportive, and they have dedicated some resources to doing community outreach, to find out what the community wants, what the community needs, et cetera. So overall, that's what introduced me to this topic. Once I became a senator, I also inherited another orphan highway, and that is Powell Boulevard, which is Highway 26 as well. And so my concern for this issue at least doubled. And, you know, in conversations with Senator Beyer, I learned that the group that was meeting to look at our transportation needs, the Transportation Forum, had been talking about orphan highways. And I learned that Portland was not the only part of the state that had this challenge, that actually we have orphan highways all over the state. And the ultimate solution to the problem of orphan highways really needs to be looked at statewide and made, you know, an ongoing sort of process. You know, if funds were to become available to allow for a jurisdictional transfer, obviously that would not meet all the needs that are out there. And so we really need to look at this in the short term, over the long term, and you know, try to you know, figure out a long-term solution to this question. And when issues of that kind of magnitude come up, it's really, I think, best not to just deal with them in the framework of a legislative session, but you know, this is an appropriate use for a task force. Hence this bill. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions, Senator Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming and explaining this bill a little bit to us. I'd like a little bit more explanation. Just as an example, use 82nd, which is the one you know. What is the desired outcome? I mean, you talk about giving him the right to transfer. It's now an ODOT, which means it's a state highway. And the residents would like it to be what and why?
Well, sir, Senator Riley, Chair Beyer, as I understand it, there are certain things that you can do with a local road that you can't do with a state road, with a state highway. There are perhaps ways to get to the same place via a state highway, but it's difficult. Just generally speaking, you know, if you just think about the purpose of a state highway, it's to get you from point A to point B as quickly as possible. Whereas once it enters a city where there's a fair amount of population, then you really need to think about different speed limits, different crossings, different perhaps you know, signage and trees, and you know, people are more concerned about the beautification of the area, and those all, as I understand it, become much more difficult when it's a state highway. And very appropriate for that highway when it's in its interurban phase. But once it enters the city, it's you know, it's different.
If I might contribute a little bit, I'm a co-sponsor in this as well. It's an issue I've been working on for a long time. I think it's a matter of priorities. In a lot of cases, in fact, I think probably in most cases, the ones that we consider orphans, the reason the term orphan came up is they've been replaced by a bypass or another highway or something like that, but they're still on the books as a state road. The problem is that cities usually don't want to take them. They'd like to have control over them, but they don't want to take over the financial responsibility for them, particularly if they're not in good shape. Mm-hmm. in conflict with that is because they're not a top priority for the state. The system, the state system, doesn't necessarily keep them in good shape. So there's always a push and pull on that. And they might be willing to take them over if they were fixed first, if you will. So there's kind of a trading idea concept that floats around there. Whether we have the resources to do that or not is another question. But that's kind of the dilemma. And I think the other one is Senator Denbrough was getting into is you may recall from when you were in the House a discussion over access management, which is, as Senator Denbrough said very clearly, the state mandate is to move traffic rapidly. That doesn't always fit well inside of cities, and where we're talking about limiting access points on highways, which is a good thing, when you start getting in a place like 82nd Avenue or 6th and 7th Avenues in Eugene, it doesn't always fit very well. And so there's the one-size-fits-all kind of a problem, which causes a dilemma for rules and regulations. So that's kind of the push and pull on it. There aren't any easy answers.
Right. Can I follow up a little bit?
Sure.
Thank you. The other thing is, take Highway 26, which is, Powell, I think. And so if we transfer that to the city of Portland or Multnomah County or whoever it is that would like to take it over, does State Highway 26 stop and then begin again? Is that not going to be confusing if that happens?
Those are, I suspect, all issues for the task force to look at.
Okay. Things to look at. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, we did have a jurisdictional transfer happened recently for another highway in my district, and that's Sandy Boulevard. Mm-hmm. You know, Sandy Boulevard is also Highway 30, I think. Yeah. But when it's in Portland, it's Sandy. And, finally funds were found, and Sandy was fixed up and was transferred over to the city of Portland. And I think that worked out quite well. But again, it happened. I don't know that it was part of a larger plan that, we'll do Sandy, then we'll do this, then we'll do that. I think it's time for us to look at that sort of planning.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm good. You kind of covered it.
Other questions, Senator Monroe?
Well, and another thing is these highways within a city often become more appropriate as a boulevard with the amenities of a boulevard. Maybe some green areas, some center islands, certainly access to cross for pedestrians and individuals. Speed then becomes less important than the kind of the livability of the neighborhood that this highway goes through. So Highway 26 is a classic example. On the west side, Highway 26 is a freeway. It's the Sunset Highway. But on the east side, it's more appropriate as a boulevard. And in fact, up between the river and I-205, it is a boulevard. Beyond I-205, it hasn't been developed yet, and it needs to be developed as a boulevard. Some of us have been working on for a while.
Senator Girard.
Yeah, I think the Senator Barr hit the nail on the head, though. Most cities, maybe Portland being large enough that they could afford to do this, almost all cities don't have the funds and they don't want the responsibility of maintaining a state highway unless we undergo a major expense and fix it up. So I think that's probably the major problem, but that can be worked out in the task force, maybe how we can come up with some creative solutions to help that.
Okay. Others?
Yes, and let me say, that would be a large part of the point of the task force, Senator. I do want to say that, ODOT has been very helpful with this process. And, I think what I've heard again and again from ODOT is that they you know, they're not in a mode where this is ODOT property and we want to hold on to it at any cost. They want to do what's right for the residents, you know, and the users of the thoroughfare.
But it saves ODOT money if they would transfer it.
Not necessarily. Eventually. Not if you weren't going to spend it anyway.
Yeah, that's true, too. That's true, too.
Yeah.
Thank you, Senator.
Okay, thank you all.
Now, Andy. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm here, too, to support Senate Bill 117. My name is Andy Cotugno. I'm a Metro Policy Advisor, having spent the last 36 years dealing with transportation-related issues in the Portland metropolitan area. Metro's role is to deal with these kinds of cross-jurisdictional issues, and especially in transportation. The federal government requires that there are organizations like us because an urban transportation system is multi-jurisdictional, multimodal. They want to make sure their money is spent in a way that accounts for who owns what piece and what kind of improvements are we trying to do to that system. So this issue fits exactly into that kind of category. I participated, it was referenced, with the Oregon Transportation Forum in developing their recommendations. They actually recommended that you implement legislation to start a pilot program that would dedicate a 1 cent gas tax increase to try out some of these kinds of projects and to learn from the application of that resource for, say, a decade and use that learning experience to actually establish policy and protocols for how it might be implemented. And I've provided a copy of that proposal that provides more details attached to my testimony that describes some of the problems and some of the characteristics of how you might administer such a program. Senate Bill 117 is at least a step in that direction. Maybe you don't implement the program, you have them vet the program to then implement, hopefully at the next session, but it's definitely a step in the right direction.
Thank you. Questions, Andy?
Oh, I've got one.
George?
I know you throw out the 1 cent gas tax, and I know that that could fly in Portland, but I represent Sile and Mill City and those sort of communities, and this isn't a viable option for them. It's just not. So I would be appreciative if you would think about doing it through Metro and not statewide.
Well, I think it would be a voluntary program, but
not the 1 cent gas tax.
Oh, okay. All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Andy. Let's see here. Mr. Honeyman. And Paul, do you want to come on up, too? Welcome, Greg.
Thank you, sir. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Pardon me. My name is Craig Honeyman. I'm with the League of Oregon Cities. Appreciate the opportunity to testify this afternoon concerning Senate Bill 117, creating the joint or the jurisdictional transfer task force, a bill which I am here to say this afternoon the League supports. Having said that, I want to point out that the League would much prefer addressing the issue of jurisdictional transfer as portion of a more comprehensive transportation package, inclusive of the 1 cent dedicated gas tax increase that Mr. Cotugno just referred to. That is part of the Oregon Transportation Forum proposal, but I understand there's some doubt concerning the viability of that package at this point in the session, so this bill would be a good start in the right direction. Jurisdictional transfer is a process, which I believe Mr. Mather is going to talk about in a minute, that it's a process and a system that's already in place, but it is not adequately funded. Like everything else seemingly relating to transportation infrastructure, it's about the money, or at least mostly about the money. Funding both for upgrades prior to the transfer and maintenance after the transfer, at least for a period of time. Also concerned, cities are also concerned about the liability impact when a substandard and underfunded asset is transferred. Now, I'm proud and pleased to point out that the League has already participated with ODOT and the counties in some preliminary feasibility studies. In fact, a couple of years ago, we were involved with ODOT in three city-county couplets where we got city transportation officials together with the county and ODOT to talk about how this might work going forward. The three couplets, by the way, were Forest Grove in Washington County, Corvallis, Benton County, and LeGrand and Union County. So the goal should be to align jurisdictional and ownership with roadway function. The benefits are many, including the reduction in management and equipment duplication, increased efficiency as streets are often or usually operated and maintained differently than highways, as has previously been acknowledged, and of course the opportunity to localize management as manifested by issues such as land use planning, access management, and permitting. Jurisdictional transfer is a good idea, especially in growing communities and on a case-by-case basis when a road serves local interests, but not so much anymore the interests of the state. Possible examples include urban arterials that are serving local travel needs for shopping, business, and recreational purposes. Urban streets that remain state-owned after a parallel major improvement has taken place. Or frontage roads that function as a city streets while controlling highway access. Examples of all of these occur throughout Oregon, not just in the Portland area, and I believe ODOT has substantially identified them and could share them with the task force. So again, it comes down to financing. Cities will be the receivers for the most part, although not exclusively, and we would hope that the decisions made on jurisdictional transfer will be voluntary and negotiated with the state and or the county. So in conclusion, the League supports Senate Bill 117 with the caveat again that we would prefer inclusion of this concept in a comprehensive transportation package. Failing that, it's a good idea to pursue the task force proposal. We appreciate the fact that urban and rural cities would be included on this task force, and I would be happy to suggest names of people who could serve and provide any other additional assistance as necessary. Appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Greg. Questions, Greg? Seeing none. Paul?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator. I thought I'd just give you some background on the issue, some context, and maybe answer a few questions. You saw my testimony. I'm going to go over a few examples in there and a diagram I'm going to refer to. When the highway system was created 100 years ago, many of these highways were city streets or county roads and were actually transferred to ODOT, or then the Highway Department, to create the state highway system. In fact, 82nd Avenue was one of those that was a county facility at the time that became a state highway. Over the years, we've done a number of transfers, and in some cases, some very significant transfers as a result of successful negotiations between ODOT and the city and or the counties. Probably the more typical way that we've made transfers is when we've built major facilities, the interstate being probably the most obvious example, where we've built I-84, many sections of old Highway 30 have been transferred to local government, but not all. Same thing with Highway 99 and I-5. When I-5 was built, many sections of 99 have been transferred, but there's many sections that have not. 82nd Avenue, again, is an example of that. When 205 was built, 82nd, at that time, probably was a logical time to make the transfer, and it wasn't. And thus, during those subsequent years, over the last 30 years, our focus has been on 205 and not on 82nd Avenue for, I think, for fairly obvious reasons. The benefits to doing these transfers are really about better government. Transferring ownership of a local highway that acts and walks and talks like a city street or a county road and having county commissioners and city councils make decisions with those communities really makes for better government. Rather than asking ODOT, a statewide agency, trying to get engaged in every community, I appreciate Senator Demereaux's remarks around 82nd and how we've tried to engage with the community, and I think we've done a good job. That's an extra effort for us to do that, and do that in every community in every case, I don't think is the most efficient use of government when you have got a city or a county government there to serve that purpose. It also allows us to really focus on our mission of being a statewide agency and focus on those routes that serve the statewide purpose. So it really boils down to, as Craig said, it really boils down to funding and the lack of funding we have to make these transfers. In the testimony that I provided, there's a diagram in there, I think, that illustrates really the phenomenon that's been happening. Over the last, say, 100 years, we've been doing these transfers, as they've
have made sense, and we've been able to come to negotiations. But over the last about 10 years, that has really slowed down significantly. In fact, one of the examples that was cited was Sandy Boulevard. And the funding that came for Sandy Boulevard and that transfer, it actually came from you. It came from the OTIA, I believe it was OTIA 1 funding, was focused on some of these routes and allowed those improvements to be made and those transfers to happen. And that's the type of thing that needs to happen now to, again, to facilitate these transfers and again, to make communities better and to make government better. What we're forced with now or faced with now is we prioritize our system or triage our system. We look to our most important asset that we as a state have to maintain, and that's the interstate system. We move down that triage list. We move to the statewide highways, down to our regional highways, and down to our district highways. And many of these orphan highways are in that district category. And again, if we're faced with limited funds and we've got to put improvements on 205 or improvements 82nd, just about every time 205 is going to win out in that debate on unlimited funding. And while that's a very low priority from a state perspective, from a local perspective, that is a very high priority for that community, as again the senator talked about earlier. So there's that gap that's created in our overall hierarchy of highways or down to city streets. There's a gap that's created right in the center of that. That really, again, it's about funding to fill that gap. In the testimony, also, I gave you a couple maps in there that shows you that this is not just unique to Portland. This is a statewide issue. There's a statewide map you can kind of make out on there. A few of the examples of highways that we have. I've heard them as orphans highways or legacy highways that really date back to, again, the creation of the highway system 100 years ago, that many of those, as we have evolved over time, do not serve the function they did 100 years ago. And then I've got specific regional maps that you can look at. Some examples in the Portland area, where we have a number of highways both on the west side of Portland and on the east side of the metro area that fit this category. And in many cases, there are routes that should be talked about as transferring to the state. And in the Portland area, one of the conversations have been about Cornelius Pass Road and whether that should be a state facility. In Lane County, I think many people using the highways in the Eugene Springfield area don't realize that Delta Highway is actually a county facility. Even though it acts and kind of walks and talks like a state facility, it's actually managed by the county. And again, we could be much more efficient as government if ODOT had all the freeway system in the Lane County area and not the city street or county road facility. A couple other examples that are in there, one in Crook County and in Klamath County, just to give you a sense of some of the things that are around the state. So I guess this is in summary, a couple of points. One, it's really about better government, about making government more efficient and more accessible to the people that we serve with these highways. But what's really needed, as Craig pointed out and others have pointed out, it's really the funding needed to fill the need of these local highways, to make them serve the communities better, to make the transportation system healthier, and to make the communities healthier by allowing these communities to grow in a way that they want to grow. With that, I'll take any questions.
Questions of Paul? Don't see any. Good. Thank you. Thanks. Very much. That's all I had on the list. Does anybody else wish to testify on Senate Bill 117?
Just real quick.
Welcome, Bob.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations, and I apologize for not signing up. I really didn't intend to testify. But after listening to the testimony, I just would like to make one point. Senator Dembro and Paul both talked about making transfers both ways, from local governments to the state and vice versa. The way the bill is written, it only allows for transfers from the state to local government. If you look on page 24, or page 24, line 24, page 1. Mm-hmm. So I would only suggest that if you intend to move this bill, that you would amend that so that they would also consider transfers going the other direction.
Fair.
Okay. Thank you.
Any questions, Bob, before he gets away? Cindy, thank you. That actually isn't fair.
It's a good pickup.
Good catch. Anybody else? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 117, and we will then move to, let's see if we can get an amendment to fix that, make it both ways. All right, so now we're going to head into tax credits. I think that's, we're down to that. 45. We are, the discussion on tax credits is this, is we started a process, I think it's 2 years ago, where annually the co-chairs of Ways and Means set a target for tax credits that will be allowed, an amount of money. And then there's a special tax credit committee. It basically looks just like the Revenue Committee that will hear these later on. The various tax credit bills by subject area referred to the committees of jurisdiction, and we make a recommendation to that committee. So what we're going to do today is we have three bills up on tax credits. The intent of the chair is that we're going to hear testimony on them, and we'll bring them back a little later after you've thought about it to make our recommendations to the tax credit committee. I think we have some time, and that committee is unlikely to meet until late May, potentially not until after the revenue forecast, but we'll see. We'll see on that. So having said that, we will start first with opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 45. James?
Senate Bill 45 extends sunset for tax credit for qualified equity investment from July 1st, 2016 to July 1st, 2022. We do have a revenue light statement, and we also have a fiscal impact statement, and there's a subsequent referral to joint tax credits.
Mr. Campbell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of the Coalition for Capital in favor of Senate Bill 45. I will not be able to do this one all in one breath, so my apologies for that. Low-income community jobs initiative was created back in 2011, and over the course of its life, it has created a little shy of 1,900 jobs. You should have a brochure in front of you that we put together that tries to capture our progress to date. What this program essentially does is it allows investments that match the federal New Markets Tax Credit. It has some certain specific requirements in Oregon that are unique to other states. One of which is that, as with the federal government, or the federal New Markets Tax Credit, it has to be invested in a low-income census tract area, which is determined by every 10-year census. We had a pretty dang good map before the last census, which for Oregon is not good because it means that there's a lot of low-income census tracts in this state. It got better after the last one, meaning it was getting worse, and there were more areas where these investments could be made. We've put some restrictions on how these are going to be used because our goal here was to try to create jobs and focus our attention predominantly on small businesses. And as a result, the investments must be made where a business has gone and been refused either in whole or part for the funding for a job growth effort or program. Excuse me. What's unique in Oregon is that we cap it. Initially, it was at $4 million. We found out that that wasn't working, so we increased it to $8 million in order to facilitate some of the projects that were happening. In Oregon, you can't use this program to build a building an apartment, those sort of things, or a business structure, unless that specific structure is necessary for running the small business that is building it. So in other words, I couldn't build a business center in the hopes that I could attract businesses to come in and do business there. I can't do a hotel, I can't do apartments. But if I'm trying to do a manufacturing process, I can build a building for that purpose. So those are the limitations. Oh, thank you very much. Those are the limitations on how this money is to be used. And it takes advantage of the new markets tax credit. That money can be invested anywhere in the union. And quite frankly, we were not getting much of it here in Oregon. We had some money originally when the program first started, but that money quickly went elsewhere until we started up this project. And you can see by what's in front of you that we've been very successful in creating jobs throughout the state. It's been a combination of both for-profit and non-profit, which personally was a bit of a surprise, but it has resulted in some successful programs throughout urban and rural Oregon, specifically around creating dental facilities, creating jobs in such places as Wallawa, where we have an integrated biomass company that created 20 jobs. And for out there, that makes a huge difference to that economy. In addition, Fry in Ontario just added 304 jobs. Some of these facilities would have shut their doors if they didn't have this assistance, and some of them, they never could have added the additional jobs without it. Now, we have asked for those who make these investments to reply with certain information to make sure that we're seeing that it's a good investment. Included in that is the number of jobs that are created, the average salary of those that are being hired, whether or not it is a new or retained job, and whether or not there are health care benefits that are being provided. Most of the jobs that are being created have health care associated with them. I will indicate that there is a glitch that we tried to create in 2013, or solve in 2013, which apparently we didn't get quite right. Insurance companies provide a large amount of money for these investments. Oregon is subject to a retaliatory tax, which essentially is designed to make sure that an Oregon insurance company doesn't gain an advantage against an out-of-state insurance company. So we have a retaliatory tax that kind of evens things up. In this case, what it did is if you were an insurance company who wanted to make an investment, a new markets investment, and gain the tax credit, your retaliatory tax would go up to the exact extent that you would have gotten a tax credit. So essentially, there was no incentive whatsoever for you to invest money in an Oregon New Markets Tax Credit project. We thought we fixed that in 2013, but after we did it, we successfully passed it through the legislature. We got word from our insurance investors that didn't work. So we have bills during the session that are designed to address that. However, if it is acceptable to this committee and there's time, we would like to use this as a vehicle to make that amendment as well. Essentially, if there isn't an extension of the tax credit, there's no reason to resolve the problem since this first round of tax credits has already gone out. However, if we do extend this tax credit, then it makes good sense for us to try to bring investment dollars from insurance companies, bring those dollars to Oregon, and invest them in Oregon small businesses. I can certainly go on for a long time about this particular program, but I think it'd probably be better for me to answer any questions you might have about it. And I know that there are experts in the room if you have any detailed questions that can answer it better than I can.
So, Craig, my understanding is that we're talking about moving the year, but the effectives, and I think we have a cap of $16 million in any one year.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Statute. Yes, that's correct. And this is a very complicated tax credit in the way this would work. It actually would count as a new allotment down the road, but it would have to wait until the annual allotment wasn't fully used, and then the new money could come in over time. So it extends the tax credit, but it also allows for more investments than are currently in the system to be made. It's a real complicated way of doing it, and quite frankly, we're having discussions with legislative revenue about a way to make it far easier to understand and, quite frankly, far less onerous on the Business Oregon to try and make sure that they're meeting that annual cap and then replace that with an overall cap. One other little confusing thing about this particular tax credit is the way it's designed, it's a 7-year tax credit. But you don't get to take any tax credits until year three. We wanted to make sure the investments were in place and that those tax credit, that investment stayed there until the third year when a company could start taking the tax credit that they're allotted. There's another provision in this particular program that I think it's worth explaining, and that is there's a very robust clawback provision that if at any time in the 7 years the principal that has been invested in that company is returned to an investor, there's a clawback provision that pulls back all of the tax credits unless they find another eligible program in the state of Oregon to reinvest that money in a low-income census tract area. So it's really designed to make sure that the dollars stay with the company and that if they ever do come back, that those dollars are reinvested as soon as possible back into an Oregon company. Okay.
Senator Gerard?
Yeah, you kind of touched on this, Craig, and I just want to make sure that these tax credits aren't transferable. That's where we've really got into trouble with tax credits. And I don't see where they are, but I just want to make sure that that's...
We wanted to make sure that there was no stacking and no transferability, especially because when this was passed, it was right on the heels of the Betsy tax credit, and we wanted to avoid a lot of the problems that were associated with that. So I believe it can be transferred once so that you can sell the tax credit to generate the money to apply to the program, but that's it after that's done. So you can't transfer it over and over and over again like have been done with some other tax credits.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any others? Seeing none, thank you.
Right, thank you.
Chris, did you want to make any comments on this or any of the others? We do have a revenue impact. It's preliminary. It's part of the bill, and I think this is true of all of them.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. And I don't have anything particular to add. There's the tax credit review process, and there's the tax credit report that I wrote in the interim, and that should all be part of OLIS, and it went through each of the credits and takes a stab at the policy purpose and then provides a description of how the tax credit works and then goes through some preliminary and policy analysis for each of the tax credits. One point that Craig touched on, and I don't know if it would have to be in this committee or in JTACS because it's kind of a technical fix, or not even a fix, but a technical clarification, is the cap. The way that's worded in statute, is it's difficult to see the cap. And I received a number of questions about exactly what this bill does, because all it does is move the date. So you look at it, it's a half a page bill. And generally, when tax credits have a program cap, there is somewhere in statute that you can point to say that agency X can certify so many credits in a given year or given biennium. And because of the cap is, as you pointed out, $16 million a year, you kind of have to back into that number in terms of what the total investment cap is. So it would be more direct and easier for people to follow statute if the language were situated such that, or just stated such that, the program cap was X dollars per year or per biennium.
It does kind of get into the logistics question a little bit of the cap that we're looking at, or the amount that the co-chairs preliminary have identified for the two-year budget,
right,
is $14 million. This is obviously more than that, but it wouldn't affect this year's. It would affect the 18-19 biennium. I'm not sure how you deal with that.
That's correct. For the 15-17 biennium, for a couple of reasons, because the program is already sold out, because of the $16 million a year, all of the investments that have been made so far, that $16 million cap has already been hit for, I think, tax years. I'm going off the top of my head now. Somebody from the department may know more precisely. It's like tax years 15, 16, and 17 were all already going to hit that $16 million cap. So no more tax credits could be issued until probably 2017.
So do we have future obligations that are carry things that can get it, but they can't get it until future years?
Correct. The seven-year nature of the tax credit is the first 2 years of the tax credit. There actually is no tax credit. The credit percentage is zero. And then year three, it's 7% of the investment. The total credit is 39% of the investment made.
And it spreads out over how many years?
7 years.
And 7 years. So it starts in year three of year four of the investment, and so it's spread out over 4 years after it starts?
Correct. You have two zeros, Seven and then 4 8s.
Seven afterwards.
Five.
Yeah, depend, when it starts, it can be described both ways. And that's part of the reason there can't be a revenue impact for the first 2 years of extending the credit, because no credit can be claimed until year three. So you have that and the fact that no investments that will qualify for the credit can occur until 2017 because of the existing cap. Again, this discussion almost highlights and emphasizes the lack of clarity around the cap.
Yes. I was trying to visualize if we have some approved but waiting for their place in line already, and then others that might come in. Yes, Senator.
I'm a little confused, and maybe I should ask Craig this question, but dealing with the clawback principle, how can you do a clawback of the tax credit if the tax credit's been sold?
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Girod, I would have answered that question differently, I guess. I wouldn't consider it, and I'll talk to Craig afterwards, but I don't know that I would consider it transferable. Whoever earns the credit gets the credit.
Well, that's the way it should be. That's
that's my understanding of the program.
Okay.
Some people I talk to consider that a transfer, so I don't know if that's the piece that Craig was referring to.
He's shaking
not.
His head up. And
it's okay. Pre-sold.
Yeah, okay. But, well...
So whoever
that took care of the question.
Whoever
right
earns it gets it, and so I would consider that non-transferable.
Yeah, okay.
Other questions? This is going to be a hard one to fit into the shoebox of how many are available.
Yes and no. The impact for the biennium will be zero for 15-17. The $14 million is the revenue impact for 15-17.
But don't we already have some that are, in terms of the co-chair's budget, it seems like we've already spent some, unless they've, have they already considered that as part of their?
Yes.
They have.
Okay. It's part of the.
They've taken that into consideration.
Yes, it's the, in total, about $78 million in tax credits have already been issued, and that's part of the baseline current law revenue forecast that you received in February.
Okay. Further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Did you want to talk on this? No. You don't have to. I just... Is there anybody else who wishes to address us on this bill? Okay, so we'll close on Senate Bill 45, and Sir Ferriola's here. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 801. James, Senator.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 801 creates credit against income tax for taxpayers that create 10 or more new jobs during tax year, applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2016, takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment of Senate I. You have a -2 amendment, which changes the tax credit to $1,000 per job, requires jobs to earn more above the community average wage to be eligible for the tax credit, limits the tax credit to businesses with 100 or fewer employees. We have a revenue impact statement, the revenue light impact statement, and there's no fiscal issued yet.
Welcome, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. State Senator Ted Ferrioli, District 30, for the record. First, let me thank you for allowing Senate Bill 801 to be heard. This isn't rocket science. This is really a bunch of folks trying to figure out what could we do to use the economics of our situation to create an incentive for people to invest and create more jobs. And so, if you believe that the power to tax is the power to kill, then perhaps the power to use tax incentives is the power to bring to life a program that maybe will create some jobs. We started out with a little more ambition than good sense, and that's what the -2 amendment is all about, is to bring the tax incentive more in line with what we think will be the fiscal. But it's really aimed at small businesses. We're not interested in incenting mega corporations. We're interested in looking at Oregon small business, and most of those small businesses have 20 or fewer employees. What we'd like to do is infilling with a tax incentive, and that's exactly what the bill does. We think it'll be a net positive generator of revenue as more people get these jobs that could be incented, and they'll pay income taxes. So there's a feedback loop. And I noticed that the future of this bill will be really dependent on a fiscal analysis. And that's something that we encourage. We notice that there will be an automatic referral to Ways and Means. That's exactly the right thing to do. But I would request that in connection with your hearing of the bill, that you request the fiscal and let them get started with sharp pencils and calculators. And at the end of the day, I would ask you just to take a look at whether or not this thing pencils out. If we can incent some jobs, offer some tax credits to small businesses, and the feedback loop works the way we think it might, it could be something that actually creates more revenue than it costs. That'd be a good thing. So I will leave you with this before I attempt to answer any questions that you might have. I think you've seen this before. This is what we're trying to do. For the benefit of folks who can't see that. Thank you, Jobs. Thank you. Any questions, members?
Question to the senator.
I have one.
Senator?
This is a technical question, and that is, who's going to do the audit of the jobs? And that, because what I'm thinking is you got a corporation that's 60 people large. They want to increase sales by 5, but they decrease management by 7 or something. So who's going to do the audit of the jobs?
Well, that is an excellent question, Senator. I can't answer it right now, but I know one thing that has been an embarrassment to all members who voted for economic development projects in the past, and that is there hasn't been a robust feedback loop so that when we went back and oftentimes years later did audits and found out the jobs weren't created, but the tax incentives were expended.
That's right.
So there does need to be a feedback loop. If you're going to claim the credit, I would assume that you could name the job. So, you know, in proving up when they file their corporate income taxes, I would assume that we would ask them to provide documentation that they had a permanent, full-time, above-average wage job that was created in order to claim the credit.
Cool. Other questions?
Seeing it.
Thank you very
Senator
much,
Byer,
Senator.
Thanks for your consideration. Members of the committee, thanks for your indulgence.
Is there anyone else who would like to address the committee on Senate Bill 801? Seeing none. Close on Senate Bill 801, and
can we get an amendment for that?
Yeah, we are getting an amendment for it.
Not just the dash ones. I want an amendment for the audit.
For the dash twos,
we do have the dash two in the works now, but we would need a dash three for the audit piece.
Okay.
Yeah, I think you need to have an audit piece.
Yep.
Because it's been abused in the past.
I would think we would. So what have we got left? I have 52
and then 17, but 52 is that tax credit. One more tax credit.
Okay, ready to go?
Yep.
Okay. So open. Did I close? I did close, didn't I? Yep. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 52.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 52 extends sunset of corporate tax offset of insurer assessment from January 1st, 2016 to January 1st, 2022. We have a revenue light impact statement, no fiscal impact, and also a subsequent referral to JTAX will be needed when and if we move the bill.
Okay. Justin Delaney. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Byer, members of the committee. I will attempt to very briefly explain to you what a guarantee association is.
Okay.
I hope your questions are few and far between. my name is Justin Delaney. I do chair Oregon's Life and Health Guarantee Association. Guarantee Association is basically an agreement between the legislature, the insurance division, and the insurers that do business in Oregon to form a backstop to protect policyholders. It was an idea conceived by the industry and its regulators because we are regulated on a state-by-state basis, so we don't have an FDIC. So we've got a guarantee fund in each state. How those are paid for is by assessments to insurers, member insurers, I should say. You've got to get your license in the state and become a member of the association. Today, you have before you a renewal of the tax offset which is used when an insurer is assessed to pay for the insolvency of another insurance company. So the first point I wanted to convey to you is that these are assessments against the good companies for the companies that failed. This is a good thing for the state of Oregon and for consumers in the state. Questions that I think the committee anticipated having answered are, why should we renew it at the 100% level? Why not cut it in half? Why not kill it off? A couple answers to that for you. The first is what I said before. These are tax credits that are used by the companies that are paying for the failure of another company. It's, I think, good public policy to help those companies out. If you think about an insurance company paying for another's failure, that's not something we can anticipate. And the premiums that we would have to pass through to our consumers would go like this if we're paying for other insolvencies. So the tax credits have a leveling effect. In Oregon, as in most states, it's a 5-year period during which you can claim your credit. Second reason this is a good deal for the state is that insurers, our experience in Oregon has been, do not claim much more than 50% of the tax credit available to them, probably because they don't have enough taxable income in a year. So instead of taking money out of the general fund, insurers are paying for it all up front and then reaping some of the benefit of the tax credit, but not all of it down the road. It's a good deal for the state. I think I'll just leave it at that and see if you have any questions. I've got more detail I can go into. I don't know that it's really helpful, though. This is arcane stuff, I will readily admit.
So this is renewal.
This is just a renewal.
How long has it been in effect?
This has been in effect, you know, I'd say probably mid-80s, Chair Beyer. I don't have an exact year. I can look that up for you and get it to the administrator here. The overwhelming majority of states have a system very similar to this. There's some difference in the number of years insurers can claim the credits, but last I checked, it was about 44 or 45 states have a system almost identical to Oregon's.
Okay. Senator Riley.
Thank you. I don't see in the bill how much is the tax credit annually that we give
to
this?
5 years, 100%, so 20% per year for 5 years.
Yeah, dollars.
Chair Beyer, Senator Riley, these tax credits are not used very often. This is not a credit that is purchased and traded. These only come into play if there's an insolvency in the industry, if an insurance company fails, which fortunately does not happen very often. So this is truly a backstop that only occurs when something bad happens, and it has not happened for a long time.
Senator Riley, there is a revenue impact statement that says projects a loss of less than $50,000 per year.
Thank you.
And Senator Riley, I think that's probably an estimate looking back historically at how infrequently the credit's been used. It's very hard to gauge.
Just one comment. Insurance is about spreading the cost of someone's failure over the rest of the population. Why don't you just buy an insurance policy for it?
Chair Beyer, Senator Riley, that's not a bad idea. Maybe we can go into business together. My off-the-cuff answer would be you don't want to insure bad risks. And so insuring somebody for a failed business is kind of a tough proposition to underwrite.
Other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Let's see, that's all I had signed up on this bill. Is there anybody else who would like to testify on Senate Bill 52? You see, you're bouncing in your seat there, John. We're not sure.
No, thank you.
Okay. We'll close on Senate Bill 52. Again, these are all tax credit bills. We will take them up at a later date as a group and make our recommendations to the Tax Credit Committee. Let's see. We now have, well, did I close? I did close. Mm-hmm. So I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 715. James.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 715 permits licensed insurance providers to be the licensees for products distributed through non-insurance travel retailers if specific conditions protecting consumers are met, including registration of the agents, training, and consumer disclosures. Declares emergency effective upon passage. There is no revenue impact and there is no fiscal impact.
Mr. Gardner. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I am appearing today for the U.S. Travel Insurance Association. Senate Bill 715 would update Oregon's producer licensing requirements for travel insurance to bring it into conformity with approximately 30 other states. Those states include our neighbors Washington, Idaho, and California, and soon to be joined by Nevada, which is considering similar legislation right now. The bill uses language based on a model act developed by NCOIL, the National Conference of Insurance Legislators, in 2012, and uniform licensing standards adopted by NAIC, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, in late 2010. Travel agents and insurance companies writing travel insurance have in recent years faced disparate licensing requirements in each state. And before states started enacting this model act a couple of years ago, there were 41 different licensing qualification codes to get licensed for travel insurance across the United States. Each state had a different licensing process and a different licensing procedure. Some did not accept electronic applications. And as a result of this, it could take 6 months to get licensed to sell travel insurance across the U.S., which made full compliance nearly impossible in an industry that can suffer very high turnover. This was a significant burden and a regulatory risk, quite frankly, to the 155 travel agencies in Oregon, which provide more than 800 full-time jobs and millions in direct economic impact to the state. Compliance burdens weigh heavily on these predominantly small businesses, of which 75% employ fewer than 5 people and 90% fewer than 10. The legislation would permit licensed insurance providers, the companies, to be licensees for products distributed through non-insurance travel retailers, primarily travel agents, if and only if new specific conditions protecting consumers are met. And those include registration of the agents, training, and consumer disclosure. And I would add that the American Society of Travel Agents, which represents travel agents in Oregon and across the country, joins USTIA in support of the legislation. I would also mention that we are hopefully going to be joined shortly on the phone by our expert, attorney in Washington, D.C. with the Steptoe Law Firm, who will be able to answer any detailed regulatory questions that the committee might have.
And Jim, so this is this would be, besides travel agencies, would be people like cruise lines and Travelocity, those kinds of
exactly
things.
Mr. Chair, that's exactly so.
Airlines. Let's go ahead and call him in. Mr. Fielding, this is Senator Lee Beyer, chair of the Oregon Business Committee, and we're taking up Senate Bill 715. So we'd welcome your testimony. So, any comments you'd like to make on the bill?
Absolutely, thank you. I was actually watching your hearing on the web here, and I think I'm a few minutes behind. I didn't realize that you had progressed this far. But thank you very much for allowing me to speak by phone to the committee. I appreciate it greatly. My name is John Fielding. I'm with Steptoe & Johnson, a law firm in Washington and around the country, and I work with the U.S. Travel Insurance Association. And I just wanted to echo the comments that were just made in support of the legislation. We think that the legislation is a good thing for consumers, for regulators, and for the industry that needs to comply with the rules for all the reasons that were set out a few minutes ago. There's disclosures and training in here, which we think are good for consumers. There's information that's provided and available to the regulators, as well as enforcement as needed. And then for the industry, there's a system that will allow them to comply not only in Oregon, but in other states as well. And as the travel insurance industry has grown up a bit over the last few decades, or the travel industry, I should say, and you know, folks in Salem or Portland or wherever may have clients not only in their hometowns, but in other states and across the country as well, through the miracle of the phone, of the telephone and the internet and so forth. And so these travel agents who were prior to this, you know, focused on their home states, now suddenly, not suddenly, but have now needed to be in compliance with rules and laws across the other states. And as travel people and not insurance people, this has been a compliance challenge. And so this new sort of licensing structure, we believe, works very well to make sure that everyone's in compliance and everyone, like I said, consumers, regulators, industry has what they need. I'd be happy to answer any questions or give more detail if you'd like, but I'll just turn it back to you guys. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fielding. My assumption, I believe Mr. Gardner said that, is what we're being asked to adopt is a national model standard, our statute.
That's right, sir. It was started with the NAIC in 2010. NAIC adopted uniform licensing standards applicable to travel, the travel limited line. And then 2 years later, in 2012, NCOIL, the National Conference of Insurance Legislators, adopted a model that is substantially similar to the NAIC's uniform standards, although more comprehensive, I guess. They did it in a bill structure or format, and they added disclosures and some other sort of pieces that that improved what the NAS on what the NASC had done, and both organizations, sort of came out and supported this approach. And it's enacted in, I believe, it's 32 states at this point, and sitting on the governor's desk in two additional states, West Virginia and Mississippi, is just awaiting governor's signatures.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Fielding, committee members? Senator Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 2, line 40 of the bill, it says that the retailer is to explain that they're not authorized to answer technical questions and can't evaluate the adequacy of the insurance. So what we're doing here sounds to me like, and I wanted to know why this is not true, we're asking people to sell insurance and not have any way to explain what that insurance does or how it helps you.
That's a good question, and I think Reed's subsection C definitely would lead one to ask that question. I think the reason for that disclosure is to clarify that these folks are not licensed insurance agents, and so there are certain things they're not trained to do. The fact is, under current law, they're not trained to do this either, but because they hold licenses, they're allowed to do whatever they want with respect to selling and soliciting and negotiating insurance. Under the new proposal, their activities are more constricted by law, and they merely, what they have to do is tell their clients that. So, and it's also built in here, and I can't find it, but I will, but built in here that to the extent that a client or customer has questions, the travel agent is required to say, I can't answer those questions, but here's the name and number of the licensed insurance producer, so the licensed agent, insurance agent, who will have that information to be able to walk you through that. And that is the way this has been designed, so that the licensed person is the person answering those types of technical and detailed questions.
So in essence, any liability on a claim on the insurance goes back to the producer, not to the retailer or travel agent.
Probably, unless the retailer, I would think, unless the retailer were to do something egregious, and I can't think of what that would be, but in the law, in the proposal itself, the licensed producer does take responsibility for the acts of the travel agent through whom the producer is working.
These are pretty standard policies, or at least the ones I've seen are.
Excuse me, I just sneezed. Yes, they are. I think they are by and large standard policies. But nonetheless, I think the idea is that the travel agent's business is travel and not insurance.
Yeah.
They're a distribution channel for the insurance product, and it is a service to their customers that their customers want and like, because it does help them, of course, to get the insurance, especially on trips that may be, you know, expensive or once in a lifetime or whatever. But I think that the idea is that still want someone who really knows the policy and knows the business, knows the issue, to be making the substantive, you know, sort of discussion of it with the client.
Thank you for that answer.
Thank you very much. Other questions? I see no other questions, Mr. Fielding. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Bye now. Let's see. Is there any other questions? Yes, we have Jim still here. I didn't get a chance.
Nice try.
Nice try. No. No, this is pretty good. These are pretty standard policies, at least the ones that I've seen. So, like, if you want to take a cruise in May, you might want to buy some insurance. Anybody else wish to testify on this? This is the only one I've got. Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 715. Do we have fiscals and all that?
Yep.
So let's go ahead and take it to work session then. Work session on Senate Bill 715. Chair moves Senate 15 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Or do we have a referral? No. Any questions? Or discussion, I should say. Any discussion on that? Is there any opposition to that? Okay, we will then send Senate Bill 715 to the floor with unanimous do pass recommendation. Volunteer to carry?
I'll carry.
Senator Rod wants to carry. We'll close on that, and I think we're done for the day. Anything else? We are adjourned.
Good day.
We're adjourned.
Good day.
For the day. Anything else? We